Previously on X-Men.
Coming to you live from Jersey City, it's the Movie Change Up Podcast Disney Plus Weekly Review, where each week I, Joseph Fricke, and my co-host Tristan Mayer break down this week in Disney Plus. I say it every week. It's a self-explanatory title, tells you exactly what this show is going to be. And I'll tell you right now, probably going to be a short episode because no news dropped this last week, no trailers dropped. There are really only two drops. One thing I will preface before I forget, which I am known to do. There was a Buzz Lightyear documentary that dropped on Disney Plus. However, I have heard from numerous sources of people that watched the documentary that it spoils the crap out of the movie. And so, because I want to see the new Buzz Lightyear movie, I'm going to wait and watch it after the movie comes out, and then we will review it after Tristan and I have both seen it. Tristan, normally every week I ask you what were your thoughts on this week on Disney Plus, but really there's only two things to mainly talk about, and we're going to kind of go into both of these things pretty extensively. But if there's anything else you want to bring up, or should we just kick it right into Ms. Marvel?
Two reviews to come up and no news, so I think that's all we got. I am looking forward to Lightyear, though. It'll be cool to watch that special once the movie's out, because I'm really excited for that. I'm seeing it, actually. I'm going to New York that week, so I'll be seeing it in one of the few actual IMAX theaters left in the country, so I'll be seeing the True Blue IMAX experience for Lightyear, so I'll be able to give you the review for if it's worth the trek.
All right. Can't wait to hear it. And I think with that, let's just kick it off with our first episode, and that is Ms. Marvel Season 1, Episode 1, Generation Y. W-H-Y. This episode, I think it progressed the story a little bit faster than I expected. We see her, she gets the gauntlets or the little bracelets that give her her powers, and we kind of see her explore her powers a little bit, and kind of we see the nice little relationship she has with her mom and dad, and she wants to go to Avenger Con, and I think it's kind of a cool glimpse into this world, seeing like Avenger Con exists inside the MCU. She wants to go with her friend, who's this cool little inventor guy, but her parents don't want to go. Classic like family sitcom trope of kid wants to go to a party or kid wants to do this, and the parents don't fully understand or don't want them to go. And, you know, like all kids in these type of shows, she goes, mayhem ensues. Tristan, what are your thoughts on this episode?
Yeah, we talked about last week some expectations going into this, and we were saying, look, this is not going to be our demographic necessarily. This is going to go for a younger audience than necessarily us. But we've covered stuff like Dookie Kamealoha on here before. We're really impressed by it when it's been outside of our wheelhouse. And this feels in the same vein for me. I was really impressed by this. I thought this first episode was really fun, really heartfelt, and you mentioned that it feels like a family sitcom setup, and I like that a lot. I think even though there is Avengers Con, there is more MCU name dropping here than any other show probably we've had so far, but even with all that connection, it somehow feels the least like the MCU of all the shows so far. It really does feel like a YA kind of show about high school, about a youth coming of age kind of story, and yet there happens to be the Avengers in this universe, you know. I think it's a really interesting premise, and I also am excited to see the origin story play out, because we haven't really seen like a true blue MCU origin story in a little bit, because even Moon Knight wasn't really an origin story. He was already Moon Knight, and he just kind of figured it out as he went along, you know. So it's cool to, for once again, see a true like street level person going to like the superhero level, you know, like a genuine every man, every woman, every teen going to a superhero Avengers level.
Yeah, because even like Hawkeye, Kate Bishop kind of already had the abilities and powers. It was more like channeling that into being a superhero. It wasn't like she never had shot an arrow before and now she has to learn to shoot. Like, she had the skill, she had the ability. It was just meeting Clint Barton to like push her over the edge. One of the things I wanted to talk about with you is there's a little reference made to apparently Scott Lang's been appearing on a lot of podcasts, and that's a question people have had, is how do all these people in the MCU, like the everyday people that weren't at the final battle in Endgame, know what happened in the Battle of Endgame, and now it's kind of been revealed Scott Lang has been doing these podcasts, and people, and that's kind of how people figured out and pieced together everything that went on in this final battle. And so with Ant-Man and Quantumania coming out, Ant-Man and the Wasp in whatever, I can't remember what the title, but y'all know what movie I'm talking about. Is there a way that, like, on Spotify and some of these, that they release a playlist made by Disney of, like, fake podcasts where Paul Rudd just goes, like, in character as Scott Lang for, like, an hour, 45 minutes, just describing in various details, some true, some not so true. It's all supposed to be from his perspective, and obviously Scott Lang's going to make himself look good, kind of explaining the final battle so diehard MCU fans can kind of listen to that. I feel like that's something that's already in the works, and if not, I feel like even if they don't do a bunch, even if they released one, like, I don't know if there's an actual podcast that you could say exists within the MCU that he appears in-universe as a guest on, but I think that'd be really fun.
Yeah, I think that would be a really fun tie-in, and that's a cool way to answer that question without having it be like the whole narrative revolves around answering this question, which other shows on Disney Plus sometimes seem to do. Yeah, it feels like it's just thrown in, like a fun little reference. A lot of the references do feel thrown in. I think it would be great to see Paul Rudd do an actual podcast setting up to Quantumania, and I think it actually feels like something Marvel would do. There was a really hilarious clip recently on where Paul Rudd was on Conan, and if you've watched his history with Conan, he has this bit where he always wants to play the Mac and Me clip, this kind of infamously bad clip from a really terrible movie, and he always kind of gets Conan and sets up a clip from his show, whatever he's working on, and then plays the Mac and Me clip every single time he's been on Conan for like decades at this point. And he went on Conan's podcast recently, and he started talking about how Conan's like, oh, what are you working on now that, you know, we're kind of getting out of the pandemic and that kind of stuff. And he said, oh, actually, I'm doing this Audible drama. He started naming all these big name actors who were in this Audible drama with him. And he started talking about the plot and the premise. Conan was like, oh, wow, I didn't know you were doing this. And he says, yeah, I brought a clip of the audiobook if you want to hear it. And of course, he plays the Mac and Me clip. I thought that was a really hilarious way to subvert that, and be, even on a podcast he's playing the Mac and Me clip. But yeah, that made me think of that instantly, because I was like, what if he was somewhere in his brain he was actually doing this, and he said that to make the joke work.
Yeah, I think it would be great if, I think Conan would be the perfect person. Like, you could drop it as an actual episode of Conan, like Scott Lang as the ghost on Conan O'Brien Needs a Friend, and then in universe Ant-Man and the Quantumania, you can either like show a clip like someone's watching that podcast, or just have a reference to like him saying he was on Conan. I think that'd be the perfect like marketing for this movie.
That would be really fun, and I'm curious to see how much they tie in other characters. Like, we didn't get any actual, well, we got one like very minor cameo in the post-credit scene, I guess.
Are we supposed
other
to
MCU characters?
Are we supposed to know who those people are? Because they look kind of familiar, but I don't know if I just recognize the actors from other things or if they've been in other MCU stuff.
That is the Department of Damage Control, most recently seen in Spider-Man No Way Home, and a handful of other. They're kind of the cleanup crew of the police who kind of is investigating a lot of superhero-related things. And I believe the one guy was one of the people who interviewed Peter Parker after he was revealed to be Spider-Man.
All right. To bring it more back to Kamala Khan and Ms. Marvel and not so much Ant-Man, one of the things I wanted to bring up was the gauntlets and the bracelets. I didn't think, like, that they would give her her powers right away. I thought maybe she would have to do something to activate it, but she put them on and, like, we're off to the races. So I want to know, do you think maybe something happened recently, maybe because of all of the alien technology on Earth, maybe kind of unlocked them and unleashed them, or do you think maybe her grandmother and maybe her mother even had these powers? Kind of what are your...
Yeah, I really am curious how they're going to fill in this power situation, because obviously it's way different than the comic book power is, and it's not just looking different, there's a whole different origin to it, and I do wonder how much they're going to get into it. Is it just going to be like, oh yeah, ancient bracelets, now you get the powers, or is there going to be a whole origin story, kind of ancient history to it? I'm really curious to see how they tie that all together, and I do think they're going to go along the path of having the grandma was some kind of like ancient superhero, not ancient, but, you know, in her time superhero, and maybe the mom similar to like turning red or something. She had the access to that power, but she kind of locked it away and didn't want it to be part of it. And we've seen that in a lot of dramas like this, where, you know, the grandma had some kind of rebellious streak, and then the mom, in her own rebellion, turned against that and became very strict. I think it'll be interesting because the parents here are something that I'm curious to see if they do more with emotionally, because obviously they're right now just kind of the dorky parents of a teenager, and like you see them very much as Kamala sees them, as kind of like the dorks who are in charge of her, and she loves them, sure, but like they just don't understand, you know, how could they possibly understand? And I'm sure we're going to get more with, they actually do understand Kamala. They were teens once too, and we kind of get some connection there, and I could see the mom having some history with the bracelet being their connection, two very different people coming together.
Yeah, I could definitely see that as an option. I'm trying to think. Anything else you want to talk about? One of the things I was surprised by, there wasn't really much of like a villain or antagonist set up, I guess, other than the post-credit scene, but I feel like they could potentially almost be more allies than antagonists. So do you think do you think the problem in her trying to be a superhero is more going to be the antagonist, and it's just going to be little antagonists like bank robbers and kind of small level guys throughout? Or what do you think the issue is going
to
be?
I'm sure they'll build up to some kind of larger level antagonist. I'm not sure what they'll do with it. And I think the Department of Damage Control is kind of set up here is like, oh, they're going to investigate Kamala Khan. They're going to like, you know, interrogate her and try and arrest her. But I think the turnaround is going to be that they're going to end up kind of recruiting her and asking her for help on some kind of mission. And she's either going to take it on with them or she's going to take it on herself. And her and her friends are going to be kind of like, you know, spies working on whatever mission that the Damage Control Department is working on. So, yeah, I like that they didn't give us a villain at all. I like that this first episode is very much focused on Kamala and her POV. You really get time in her life, and you don't get her powers at all until the last scene. So you really take the time to learn to know her family, get to know her, get to know her friends, her like kind of social status. And I think that was really effective because you know this character now going into her actual superhero arc because you spent this time with her.
Anything
one thing else? I want to mention didn't mention is the kind of stylistic editing that goes on once in a while. Like, similar to the comic, because the comic book, she writes fan art and she does fan fiction. And so the opening scene of her comic book is similar to the opening scene of this, where we're seeing what we come to learn is a fantasy sequence of all the Avengers fighting a bad guy. And they do the same thing kind of here, where instead of a fantasy sequence, it's just comic book art. But yeah, I thought that was a cool reference to the comic. And yeah, there's these interludes where, like, written on the side of the walls, the graffiti will change, and or will be like characters walking around hand drawn. So you kind of get the perspective that like you're in her head, you're in her like artistic brain, you know, you're seeing her like fan art living out throughout the world. And I thought it was really unique and cool. We talked about the MCU needing to kind of freshen things up, and things kind of starting to feel the same stylistically. Even with stuff like Moon Knight, it still kind of felt the same in a lot of places, and I've never seen something like that in the MCU. Something so stylistic and so kind of non-diegetic, I guess would be the word to say it. Maybe it's diegetic. I don't know how. Whichever the one is not on the screen is the one that it is, because it's very like subjective, and I think it's cool.
Yeah, definitely. Anything else you want to say about Ms. Marvel? Is kind of pretty much a straightforward episode, and especially as someone that doesn't know the character that well, it's kind of hard to like speculate as far as what can happen in the future, what can go on from here.
Yeah, I don't want to speculate too much. I have read the arcs that this is based on, but I think the fact that they haven't even revealed the villain yet or anything kind of shows that they're playing a little bit slow, so I don't want to give away too much. But if you want to get ahead and you want to see where it comes from, the first volume of Ms. Marvel is available for free on Amazon Prime. So if you have Prime, not to cross promote the other guys, but you can go ahead and check that out on Amazon Prime.
Yeah. All right. Yeah, I'm definitely enjoying the show a little bit more than I thought I would. I don't know where it'll rank as far as the MCU shows once this is all done, but it shows a lot of promise, and I'm looking forward to the rest of them. And
I really like her in the lead as well. She's very
good
actress.
The actress is really great. I love that she's a fan. Apparently, even before she was cast, she was very active on the Marvel Studios spoiler subreddit. So she is a hardcore MCU fan, and I always kind of love when people like that get cast in these type of roles. So,
she's already arguing with Kevin Feige about what the MCU's universal number is compared to the comic book.
I saw that, and I saw, not to get off track a little bit, but someone had a great theory, because in Spider-Man Far From Home, Jake Gyllenhaal's character refers to the MCU as Universe 616, and I'm like, and people are like, how did he know that? And someone had a great theory, or just great like thing that they could use in the future, is that his character in another universe was part of the Illuminati, and because like the Illuminati know of the multiverse and they know of all of this information, maybe through a dream, it wasn't necessarily like how, but it was just like almost like subconsciously he knew that he was in universe Earth, or he was in Earth 616, and so that's
an interesting theory. I really am curious to see where they go forward with all that stuff. I'm curious to see how stuff ties together, you know, because we've seen some stuff tie in and some stuff not. It feels like they tie when they want to and they don't when they don't.
Yeah, I feel like that's one of those things the MCU is never going to touch on, and if anyone ever presents that theory to Kevin Feige, he's going to be like, yep, sounds good to me. And same with Eric Selvig, the main science guy in the Thor movies. In one of the chalkboard scenes in one of the first two Thor movies, he had Earth 616 written on a chalkboard. It's like, how would he know that he was at Earth 616? And you could probably come up with the same reason. Maybe in some multiverse somewhere, he is a great genius scientist that rose to be a member of the Illuminati, and now he subconsciously knows that he is in Earth 616. So
I have one last theory if you want to get it before we head out of this topic.
All right, and we'll move on to our, I guess, final subject of this episode.
Yeah, so in the comic book, she gets her name Ms. Marvel because rather than having these kind of like Green Lantern-style powers, she can shapeshift, kind of Mr. Fantastic-style sort of, and she shapeshifts by accident into her most prized hero, Captain Marvel, and then people kind of see her. And then when she rescues Zoe, who is the kind of bully in this episode, is also the bully in the comic book, and she rescues her in Captain Marvel's shape. So people start calling her Ms. Marvel because they think, oh, the old Captain Marvel's back. And I think they're going to subvert that a bit. And the videos we saw people taking are going to be viral online, and they're going to see a little kid wearing Captain Marvel's costume, and they're going to say, oh, it's like a little Ms. Marvel. You know, and she's going to be kind of like, get her name that way.
Yeah, I can see that. Definitely an option.
It'll be a cool subversion of the, not a subversion, but like a redo of the version of the comic book, because they obviously aren't doing the shape-shifting powers, but it's a fun way to still do the same kind of origin where she's in the Captain Marvel costume when she gets revealed to be a superhero.
Yeah, I could see. It's definitely an option. If that's what they go with, I dig it. I'm going to do it. And with that, I think we're going to our next topic, which is Obi-Wan Kenobi, one of the most highly contested, most controversial shows on TV right now.
Somehow.
It's part 4 of Obi-Wan Kenobi. I feel like half the internet loves it, half the internet hates it. Plot of this episode, basically, Princess Leia's been kidnapped, and General Obi-Wan Kenobi has to go rescue her. Where have I seen this before? If you watched our previous episode, I said, hey, all of these episodes are going to basically follow similar beats to the movies they match up with. When we were predicting what would the one be in part 4, the fact that we forgot that Leia had been kidnapped left our minds. Hopefully. Because episode 4 was the one we struggled with the most of how is that going to connect to the movie. But it's not one of those things where I'm like, oh, they're just ripping off the movie. It's definitely kind of intentional. I like it. I like the idea. I really like the show so far. I mean, we're 4 out of 6 episodes in, so I think it's safe to say, in general, I just like the show. I like the direction. Kind of a simple plot this episode. It starts off very abruptly, to the point that I feel like some of this was cut, especially, or some of the early stuff was cut, like with characters like Wade. But yeah, what were your kind of general thoughts on this episode?
Yeah, I thought this episode was all right. I thought it was definitely the weakest so far. I think the fact that it's such a filler story hurts it a lot, because it's kind of just, oh, Leia's kidnapped, Obi-Wan goes and he rescues you again, and now they're back together again, and it's like, we only have 2 episodes left, and it's like, why are we spending time on essentially doing what we just did again? I think that's kind of a problem here, and I think there's I don't want to just rail on the episode because I do have some positives, but I think that there's a decent amount of negatives here, and I'm starting to lose a little bit of steam on the show a bit. I'm still positive on it. I still think that I believe in it turning things around, but I'm starting to waver, Joe. A little bit of, I can feel the wind. I can feel the wind pushing me, swaying me around. But what I do love about the show is Leia. I think they've nailed her shockingly well. I never thought I'd walk out of the Obi-Wan Kenobi Ewan McGregor show saying they really did a lot to add to Princess Leia's character. And I think the actress is doing a good job. I know she's actually getting a decent amount of hate herself online, but I think she's doing a good job of like the overly confident young kid that Leia would be, with the slight kind of like privilege to her that Leia would have because she's been growing up in like a literal princess's castle most of her life. So I think it fits really well. But I love that moment where she says, "Oh, we can go get my dad then, because they're both on the same side," during that interrogation scene. You already see like the cunning kind of rebel within Leia. Yeah. So people forget that Leia already knew Vader in episode 4. Like, he walks in and she says, "Oh yeah, Vader, of course. Like, I knew it would be you." So you see they have a history there. So I imagine we see that history play out on the screen here. But I'm really looking forward to Leia's arc here more than really anything else on the show so far.
Yeah, I understand that. I like a lot of the stuff they've been doing, specifically with Obi-Wan, with him kind of reconnecting with the Force. And kind of, we see a small burst. Some people have problems with maybe how quickly he readjusted to the Force, but it didn't bother me that much because I feel like it was more like him being like slow to pick up at first, but then once he got it, he got it. In the moment where he pulled the lightsaber back as he was kind of battling those stormtroopers in the hallway, it was kind of him being like, "All right, I'm full on. I'm no longer basically Ben Kenobi. For at least the rest of this mission, I'm General Obi-Wan Kenobi and a Jedi Master." And I thought that was great. And this episode definitely felt like a love letter to the video game side of Star Wars. Like, I know you haven't finished it yet, but like the final mission in Jedi Fallen Order is you break into Fortress Inquisitoris, and that's the first time in canon we really saw it. And like, Obi-Wan was going basically down the same hallways that the main character Cal Kestis goes through in that game. And we didn't see, I'll bring up those tombs later. You don't see those tombs in the game. That's a new addition to Fortress Inquisitoris. And someone did an overlay of Obi-Wan when he's doing his lightsaber and beating the stormtroopers to the character of Starkiller in Force Unleashed. And they literally copied the exact moves. And then some of the stuff with the planning of the battle, a lot of the graphics were very similar to the original Battlefront games. So this episode, I felt like they almost like, "Hey, let's spend this episode. We have this sleek, simple mission. Let's give homages and let's give reference and a shout out to the Star Wars video games, because that's how Star Wars got a lot of its fan base." So I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah, that makes me a little bit more appreciative of some of the action here, because I am at the point where I'm like feeling like Obi-Wan's arc is a little bit unfulfilling, and I didn't get quite the state that he was. I haven't got a great picture of his mental state so far. And now that he's already kind of back in the light with the Force and the lightsaber and everything else again, I feel like there's a kind of an arc that I didn't quite fully experience there. And I think when you show Obi-Wan Kenobi, I want to really feel like the weight of Obi-Wan's mental state here. I want to feel his growth, his change, where he's at, and how he, over the course of his relationship with Leia, how that affects him. You know, I never really quite got a good picture of like how this relationship with Leia is affecting Obi-Wan Kenobi so much as it's affecting Leia. So I really hope that in these next two episodes we can get more time with Obi-Wan and more time getting a picture of what Leia means to him and why this relationship in particular kind of like pulled him back to the Force.
Yeah, I get that. One of the things I want to bring up, the tombs. A lot of Jedi we don't know, never seen before. One Jedi, if you're a fan of the Clone Wars, you know quite a bit. Terra Sanube, a Jedi that's existed since before the High Republic, fought in the High Republic, has been training younglings, even including Master, not Mace Windu. Well, he might have trained Mace Windu, but that's not who I was thinking of. He trained the one that got referenced in the previous episode. Quinlan Vos. Part of, he trained Quinlan Vos when he was a youngling. Quinlan Vos wasn't his Padawan, but there's a group of Padawans that he trained. He always takes like a section of Padawans every time, and Quinlan Vos is one of his. So I feel like maybe part of Quinlan Voss's whole thing with the path that we'll explore maybe in his own show or a comic or a novel or something, as he saw Terra Sinube there enshrined in Fortress Inquisitoris, and he's like, I need to make sure the Jedi don't fall again because of him. Or maybe
there's
it's
a
all
good Terra Sinube episode of Clone Wars with Ahsoka too, if you want to get a little good picture of Terra Sinube and a preview of Ahsoka. There's an episode with the two of them on a little quest together.
Yeah, it's kind of like her own little Empire Strikes Back force training with Luke, as she kind of learns some very important life lessons from Terra Sinube, similar to what Luke learned from Yoda. But yeah, I like this episode quite a bit. One of the things, do you have anything else you want to say before I kind of end with my whole
rant? Yeah, I don't want to move on from the tombs too quick, because I feel like that's a pretty interesting addition to the lore of Star Wars, and a big addition to kind of like the Inquisitors and their role within the Empire. Like, you wonder if there's a line between the Jedi frozen in amber to kind of like the Snoke-looking figures we saw in Bad Batch, and then to the very Snoke-looking figures we saw in Mandalorian, all the way to the Snoke himself. And I wonder if we're getting seeds planted here that the Emperor is already working his way, you know, getting the Metachlorians out of these old Jedi, and that a lot of what the Inquisitors are doing on the face of it is just kind of terrorizing the galaxy and capturing these kids for the Sith and training new Inquisitors. But in reality, I wonder if they're gathering up potential victims for Palpatine's cloning. Yeah. And I do think that the somehow Palpatine Return meme is kind of like the chip on the shoulder of Star Wars right now. And I wonder if a lot of these Star Wars storytellers feel like they specifically want to explain to us why Palpatine returned and have that make sense and not be like a rushed, weird plot point, you know. So I think that's kind of like the first sequel trilogy plot point they seem to be attacking in all of these shows so far. So I definitely think this is not the last time we're going to see this Fortress Inquisitorius with all these Jedi frozen in Jurassic Park style amber. I think we're going to come back here in some form or another, in some show or another.
Yeah, I could definitely see it. What if they originally, like in Rebels, the Inquisitors, I'm sure were 100%, like they're here to kill Jedi and capture Jedi and turn them evil. But what if they're like, okay, what if we rework that a little bit? And they think that's what they're here for. But really what they're here for is to capture Force users to be victims in Palpatine's experiments. And I see potentially, you know, maybe they're just trophies. Maybe we'll find out that each one of those is just like each Inquisitor's first Jedi kill, or something like that. But I definitely feel that there very easily could be more to it, especially with them frozen in amber, which with Jurassic Park 12 or whatever is coming out this weekend, I feel like they, especially when you have carbonite and other random things you could freeze them in, I feel like freezing them in amber is a very specific choice. And as a storyteller, one connected especially with like the Lucas and Spielberg connection, that feels like a deliberate choice of why it's the frozen in amber and not literally anything else.
Yeah, they would have probably just put them in carbonite for like the reference, if anything else, you know. But the fact that they actively made it amber, something we haven't really seen done in Star Wars before, I think that shows that they're at least trying to preserve them in some way that carbonite doesn't, you know. And maybe it's because they are dead and amber is their way of like preserving the body long term. I'm curious to see, because I definitely think we're getting more of that, and I think that's adding, like I said, to this overall plot they seem to be going with of explaining Snoke and explaining Palpatine and explaining kind of like the rise of the First Order and what that whole plan actually was.
Curious to see how that goes, especially you got Jedi Survivor coming out where it looks like another Force user hidden in a tank somewhere. What's the history with that? What's the story with that? Does that play into it as well? Very curious to see. Anything else you want to add?
One last theory I have is we've gotten a lot of Florum name dropping, especially this episode. And Florum, if you've watched the Clone Wars, is the home of Hondo and his pirate gang, who has a lot of great fun history with Obi-Wan Kenobi. And he was kind of high on the list of characters that I would have liked to see going into the show if they were going to have a lot of crossover characters. And they honestly haven't had a lot of crossover characters so far, so I'm not sure what to expect in terms of cameos going forward. But I would think it would be very cool if they had to go line down Florum for an episode or something. Maybe we get an appearance of Hondo, I know we talked about maybe Quinlan Vos showing up. I don't know where the place is for a lot of these cameos, and only two episodes left, which is the my real question is, I feel like we have a lot to wrap up character arc wise and a lot of justifying to do in terms of like why was this show made. I think in the next two episodes, so I think these next two episodes are really going to decide my overall thoughts on the show so far, because I liked the first few, but I haven't been blown away by any of them. And if this show manages to wrap it all up into something satisfying, I feel like episodes like this that feel more filler aren't going to matter that much, because in the end it still worked, you know? So I think a lot of the complaints people have about this, and myself included, will be lesser if the show ends up satisfying by the end.
Yeah, and I get that, and I feel like, especially like looking back, it'll be like, oh, this is just the episode where Obi-Wan reconnects with the Force. I feel like while it's a 40-minute episode, it's a quick episode. I don't think it's going to be one that like, oh, like you can watch Obi-Wan, but make sure you skip episode 4 because that one sucks, you know?
Yeah, I'm curious because, we've had how many episodes now, and it feels like they're still struggling to justify the plot. In a way, like, I don't feel like I've learned a lot about Obi-Wan so far.
All right, so I have one final thing before we rant, because it kind of plays off into what you said, and I think, you know, I've been doing a lot of research, I've been looking into a lot of things, and I feel like the main complaint everyone, like a lot of the people, is like, oh, the writing sucks, but basically every time I talk to people and try to figure out why, it essentially just boils down to they don't like the moment, or it feels like fan filmy, and I've been trying to dissect why, and I've looked into a lot of research. One of the things I found very interesting was, and I meant to look it up, and I knew at one point, Tristan, if you could do it for me, figure out who composed the Obi-Wan Kenobi show, because I'm blanking on her name. But basically, we knew who was doing the score for Andor like months before we ever learned who was doing the score for Obi-Wan Kenobi, which a lot of people think is random. And then I guess the guy who does kind of helps out John Williams, especially as he's gotten older, because a lot of times when John Williams scores movies, because of his age and, you know, he's still got a bunch of movies to score, he scores like a lot of the big scenes and the big moments and the big climactic parts, but he has this assistant that kind of comes through and finishes off the score and kind of...
Natalie Holt is the name of this composer for Obi-Wan.
Natalie Holt, So John Williams' assistant kind of comes through and composes a lot of like the smaller moments, and but he's also been partially credited with Obi-Wan Kenobi, and especially certain episodes he has like his credits higher than on others. And so a lot of the theory going on is Natalie Holton submitted a score and basically everyone thought it sucked and it wasn't very good, and so they brought John Williams in to compose the theme and at least have the theme, because one of the things I don't understand about this show is I've seen Mandalorian. After the first two episodes, I knew the Mandalorian theme. I knew, and it had like big music moments. Even though I didn't really care for Book of Boba Fett that much, same thing. I know the Book of Boba Fett theme. Even the Bad Batch theme, I know that one. I don't know any music at all in Obi-Wan. Like, none of it is really memorable to me. And I feel like they brought her in, they didn't like her score, and then they weren't sure about the optics of like hiring and firing and not using the score of like the first female Star Wars composer. So they just kind of brought in John Williams and John Williams' assistant to kind of fix it. And I just feel like the music in the show, whether that theory is right or wrong, I just feel like the music in the show is like, I don't know if necessarily dragging it down, but it's not elevating it. It's not making the emotional moments feel that the emotion it's supposed to have. It's like if you watched the fight from Revenge of the Sith, Obi-Wan and Anakin, and it was just kind of silent and there was no big operatic score, I don't think it would have like the same emotional feeling it does. Same with, you know, Luke versus Vader in Return of the Jedi. I feel like that's not going to have the same emotion if it doesn't have the score. And I just feel like the score is just completely lacking. It's just a basic, I don't even know if generic score. I watched the episode and I don't even know if I can hear the score, and I, you know, brought a little bit of evidence. There's two kind of, I would say, relatively viral videos if you're a Star Wars fan that one kind of, I think, broke out beyond the fandom, and that is Star Wars, the metal scene from A New Hope, and they cut out the music and they just kind of filled it in with the audio you would hear if the music was cut out and they didn't play that. So I'm going to play that real quick and then talk about it after.
Scene, but the John Williams score has been removed and it is very awkward, very uncomfortable.
This is
a lot of ringtone.
Yeah, if you're an audio only listener, maybe go check out the video version on Twitch and or YouTube. Yeah, it's just super awkward. And all right, I'm just gonna kind of stop this video here. And basically, for me, that's kind of what this whole show is. Like, if the music was good, it would... I feel like if the music in the chase scenes that people have problems with was better and there was better chasing music, like, you wouldn't notice, like, the weirdness and the awkwardness and why don't they run around this tree? Why is the editing like this? I just feel like it's... Like, if you had chicken noodle soup and the chicken was made well and the noodles were made well and the carrots were chopped great and the celery was chopped great, but the broth was just, like, three-month-old broth that's just been... sitting in the back of the fridge, you know, it doesn't mean the noodles were now made bad or the meat was now made bad or the carrots are bad, but the music, it just makes it all indistinguishably, and I feel like that's what's lowering it. That's my opinion, that the music, and I feel like the music can change emotion, and so I have one final clip to play just to kind of further prove my point, and that is a clip from, I can't remember if it's Empire Strikes Back or Return of the Jedi, but... it's Vader landing on a Imperial base, Imperial starship, and someone changed up the music, and it completely changes the tone of the scene into it's no longer menacing. And played the old clip. Now this is the clip I meant to play.
Inform the commander that Lord Vader's shuttle has arrived. Send.
And just to kind of go finish my point on this, as far as like people talk smack about Moses Ingram's acting as Reva, and I feel like that's part of the problem is she's here, she's being menacing, and then, you know, the music around her, she's not giving, like, she walks into a room, there's no like big menacing theme, she's doing menacing stuff, and there's no like big dark ominous theme, it's just random music that they found on some guy's SoundCloud, it feels like. Just playing under it, and I feel like it's not really helping her performance, and so I feel like that's ultimately the big problem with the show and why everyone has their own problems with it. And I feel like, to me personally, it all just comes back to the music, which is not good, and that's my thoughts.
Yeah, I like your metaphor where you talked about the soup, you know, and you had the score as being like the broth of the soup, and you said the bad broth can really bring down the whole soup, and I think the opposite is true too, you know, and I think the fact that some of the carrots are counted as microwaved, you know, and the fact that maybe the onions are old, but the broth is great and has great flavor to it. You can kind of overlook some of the bad ingredients on the inside of it. And I think Star Wars has a history of that. You know, you show the Chewie clip of the final scene, and it's so awkward and so quiet, and you get that Chewie roar at the end of, you're like, oh God, this is so uncomfortable. But with a good score, it's not. And I think... The weaker stuff in these Disney Star Wars shows, like the writing and some of the bad action direction, can really dissipate if you have a really good score that makes the action look cool. And I think, if they had a better score, some of this stuff wouldn't be as noticeably rough. But when you take away that extra flavor, it makes some of this direction seem like it's really lacking. And the fact that you brought in Deborah Chow to direct every single episode, it makes you wonder, like, oh, they're gonna have like this unified style, right? Like, it's gonna be kind of this small pieces of a whole, it's gonna feel like this director is one piece, but it doesn't, I mean, it feels kind of like that, but if the One Piece was just like a bland TV movie, you know, yep. I think part of the flaws with this is the directors and the writers and the composers that they get don't seem to be like movie quality level people. And you compare this to shows that are on other platforms like Stranger Things and The Boys that are made for around the same or way, way less a budget than this show is. And you just wonder like, where is the money going? Because it's not showing up on the screen. It's not showing up in the score.
Yeah.
I don't know what's happening here.
Yeah, because like for me, Indiana Jones 5 is coming out next year sometime. And I'm not excited for it because it's an Indiana Jones movie. Like, I saw the Indiana Jones movies growing up, but they weren't anything I continuously went back to. I would have much, no offense to Deborah Chow, I would have much rather James Mangold directed all six episodes of Obi-Wan Kenobi than have him direct Indiana Jones 5, and we just never get Indiana Jones 5, and we just, Kingdom of the Crystal Skull was our last, and maybe Indiana Jones 5 comes out and it's amazing, but honestly that would have probably just made me rather have him direct Obi-Wan Kenobi more. So, but yeah, I get your point too, because I know they're, Kathleen Kennedy's like, oh, we want to lock down people for these longer contracts, and I kind of like the idea for almost using the show as testing grounds for, oh, these people can direct movies, or, oh, these people can be a showrunner for our show in the future. But I almost wonder, did Deborah Chow get enough, like, did we see enough, like, essentially game film from her to fully judge her performance? Because I really like her first two episodes, or the two episodes she did for season one of The Mandalorian. But, like, I'm looking at Bryce Dallas Howard now. I love all of her episodes, and I feel like her episodes are almost maybe better than Deborah Chow's episodes. And there was rumors of the Bo-Katan show, and I'm like, oh, if they got Bryce Dallas Howard to direct every episode of the Bo-Katan show, that'd be great. But yeah, I kind of understand what you're saying. I feel like the directing could be better at times, but I still enjoy the show, still looking forward to the show, but I'm just curious like, where is all this money going? It's $30 million an episode, but is, you know, Ewan McGregor getting paid basically like $5 million per episode? Did he basically make $30 million doing this show? So I agree to an extent. Like, where is the money going? If it's really that $30 million per episode.
Yeah, because I'm positive on the show overall. I'm having a good time with the narrative, and I like seeing the characters again. But when you see, like, they should be existing on a higher plane here, production value, than they are.
Yeah.
And, like, imagine the conversation if Disney is producing, like, Game of Thrones quality, maybe not writing quality, but Game of Thrones, you could get, like, you're not going to maybe recreate the heights of the writing of the peak Game of Thrones again, you know, but you can pour enough money into a production, you can create the action spectacle, the kind of the production value of Game of Thrones again. And these are the budgets not unlike Game of Thrones budgets. Like, they should be at least delivering on the spectacle. If they can't deliver on the score and the action and that kind of stuff, you know, it should be giving us something with the money here.
Yeah, that's one of the things I'm curious about, is like, why, I don't know, like, maybe they just, I feel bad knocking Deborah Chow, but it's like, it does feel fan filmy at time, and it does feel lower production. But like, Book of Boba Fett was the same way, but almost like, that's weirdly like Robert Rodriguez's style, so in a way I kind of forgive that more. But for a show like this, which almost feels like, if Star Wars was made in chronological order, right, and they made episode 1 first and episode 2, this would have been essentially Star Wars episode 4 Obi-Wan Kenobi movie, or whatever, you know what I'm saying? And mm-hmm. So why is this just at times not, I don't know how to word what I'm saying, but I feel like you're picking up what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, I'm not going to place the blame on Deborah Chow. I think it's sort of like a top-down problem, because it's been consistent across a lot of the shows that Disney's produced, even outside of Lucasfilm.
Yeah.
It seems like somewhere along the way, the balance between creativity and just checking the boxes off and, you know, like, saving money, it feels like a lot of these shows are doing. It's like they're doing the budget approach to every single thing they can do, when I feel like they could use at least 1 or 2 episodes here and there of really going all out in the spectacle. You know, like that Luke Skywalker hallway scene from Mandalorian, I think, like, I have some issues with it because I think it's a little bit goofy, but they went in on the budget for the effects, and they really made it an epic scene with the music and the performances and the camera work and everything, and it paid off. Like, people still talk about that as one of the greatest scenes in Star Wars, even regardless of movies or TV show. Yeah. So I think that when you really bring the effort, it shows, but they seem to be rarely bringing the effort.
Yeah, it's one of those things where, like, you'd hope the show was, like, to the point where you tell people, like, okay, like, you need to watch episodes 1, 2, and 3 of Star Wars to, like, enjoy the show. Like, this is, I don't think this is ever going to be, and it probably shouldn't be a show as, like, this is your entry point into Star Wars, because there's too much backstory for it to be anyone's entry point. But it should have been a show where it's, like, you need to watch episode 1, 2, and 3 so you can watch this show. And I just feel like it's not that. Like, if you're not a Star Wars fan, and anyone's like, oh, shit, I hear people talk about this Obi-Wan Kenobi show, but I'm not really a Star Wars fan. Should I check it out? It's like, no, because it's not really going to make any sense to you. And also, it's I don't know if it's worth watching movies that you don't care about to watch this show.
Yeah, I mean, this show is not something I'd recommend to anyone who's not pre-invested into the character of Ewan McGregor as Obi-Wan, or at least Princess Leia.
Yeah,
I don't think it's nearly to the level of Boba Fett, but no. I definitely think this is not going great, but still going pretty good. You know, it's going all right.
Yeah,
I think some of the discussion is way too negative online, but maybe if you're the biggest franchise in the entire world and you're spending $30 billion, so much money per episode every week, maybe you do deserve a little bit of extra slack sometimes.
One final thought, one of the things people negatively talk about is the trench coat, Leia hiding under his trench coat thing, which didn't really bother me. It's something I could have easily seen happen in, like, episode 4 if there was a kid character. I mean, episode 4, A New Hope, if there was a kid character in that movie. And also, all of these people are on lockdown. They're all running. They're all focused on other things. No one's really paying attention. It reminds me of the video they have everyone watch at some point in school where it's like, oh, count how many times they throw the basketball, you're counting. And then at the end, they say, oh, like, who saw the gorilla? And everyone's like, wait, there was a gorilla? And then you watch the episode back, or the clip back, and, like, a gorilla, like, walked in the scene, like, jumped around and danced around, and everyone's like, well, I didn't even see the gorilla. I feel like it's one of those things. However, I would have loved if they had the bit of Obi-Wan and Indira Varma's
character. I wish they had an actual gorilla back there, you know?
Yeah.
You didn't notice the gorilla in that scene, did you, Joe?
Well, I'm just saying, I would have loved, because it's like a similar thing. People aren't paying attention. People aren't noticing. But I would have loved if they did the bit of Obi-Wan and Kenobi and Indira Varma are walking through. And, you know, it kind of looks goofy. Like, how is no one stopping them? And then there's another character who goes through the other way, who has, like, a trench coat. And you can see, like, two little legs walking. And he gets stopped by the stormtroopers. And then we're like, hey, are you smuggling a kid? He opens up his coat. And you can see, like, that's his species. He's, like, he looks human from the top up. But his bottom half, he has 4 legs.
It's like a BoJack Horseman joke.
That would have been a bit that they should have included. So, like, anyone that has a problem, it's like, oh, people probably saw him and just thought that was his species. And boom, now you have a brand new species in Star Wars because of my dumb joke.
I like it. You should be writing for Star Wars, Joe. At least writing in the dumb jokes.
Yeah, all right. Any final thoughts before we part ways this week?
Need more Hayden. You know, give me more Hayden.
I mean, Obi-Wan and Vader are definitely fighting again because we have to have the scene where Obi-Wan defeats Vader, because when I left you, I was but the learner, but now I'm the master. I think they're fighting, and I think, like, they're not going to fully redo the Ahsoka Vader fight where, like, part of his helmet comes off. I think it's going to get, like, smashed, and, like, a large chunk of his helmet is going to come off, if not most of it, and he's going to struggle breathing. But we're going to see Hayden Christensen, Anakin's face under the helmet. I don't think they're bringing him back for, like, flashback, because people are complaining we haven't got a flashback. Oh, the leaked rumor was, you know, maybe not this episode.
Who knows? Yeah, I'm curious. We got 2 episodes left. I definitely think we're going to get a reunion, Darth Vader versus Obi-Wan once again, like you mentioned. I also think we're going to have Obi-Wan kind of at his most low next week. So I think if there's any opportunity for a Force Vision type of situation, you know, he's in his training, he's in his Dagobah moment. He's going to walk into his cave and get a vision or two. I think maybe it happens next week. I'm holding out hope for at least a little bit of Force vision. Little bit here and there. You know, we got
that Force connection in the beginning, which I thought was great, which was showing them essentially fighting through the Force of, like, going back and forth. And I thought that was a great moment to start with.
Yeah, we had a moment like that in this episode where second sister, I think it is, or third sister, she's, you know, having that Force mental battle with Leia. Yeah. And you see, even at such a young age, Leia is like a natural Force user, you know, and she has that power. And one of my favorite scenes in Star Wars is, like, in Force Awakens when they have a similar scene. I love when it's like, you can tell the battle is, like, so internal and so painful, but you can't even see anything on the screen. You're just seeing them, like, staring at each other. And, you know, they always have that scene where, like, the sound kind of cuts out for a second and you're like, ooh, you know, they're Force battling.
Yeah. All right. I think that wraps up our show for this week. I got nothing else if you don't.
Nope, I've got nothing else. Glee next week. Finally, I got Joe to get himself through two episodes of Glee.
Yeah, I'm going to watch the season one premiere and the season one finale, and I'm going to tell everyone what happened in between. And I'll just say, if you're looking for a Clone Wars flashback, you may be severely disappointed. And without further ado, goodbye. Hey, thank you for watching the Movie Change Up podcast. We'd really appreciate if you liked, commented, subscribed, and shared us with anyone you think might be into what we're doing over here. Thank you. Have a nice day.